that's how it happened. She then calls me and said, is it okay if I give your name to the White House to be director of the Peace Corps? I said, sure. She said, good, because I already have. And the next day I got the phone call from the White House. And then you have to go through the vetting process. And I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, going through that process was an experience, an education, a frustration, and anything else you can add. And how anyone could be cleared to be in a presidential appointed role, like some have done, and never paid their taxes and things like that, is incomprehensible to me. With the thoroughness that they check you out and dig pretty deeply into your background.
Mm-hmm. From day one of the Peace Corps, mm-hmm. you've talked about three pillars.
Three goals.
Will you share those three goals?
Yeah, I'd have to give a little background to that because sure. As you all recall, and as I look over this audience, you remember John F. Kennedy and his leadership and his enthusiasm and how he changed the mindset of we Americans. And you remember the famous phrase, and so my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country. And that was really the seed of the Peace Corps. And a month before that, he gave that address at his inauguration. 3 months before that, in October, as he was campaigning, he stopped at the University of Michigan to give a speech. He was late, as usual, and he didn't get there till 10 o'clock at night. And he and his staff assumed they were going to probably not have that event. But when they got there, they said, you have to have it. There's 10,000 students out there waiting to hear from you. So he gave a very short talk. And then he went out into the crowd and kind of started talking with these students. And in one of those dialogues, the concept of the Peace Corps was seeded. And as he was talking with volunteers or with students about giving back and don't just go out and make money and all the kinds of things that were in his mindset. And when the idea germinated, he went to turned to one of his staff members and said, hang on to that. We're going to deal with that. And the minute he was inaugurated, he literally, one of the very first things he did is launch the initiative of what we now call the Peace Corps. And he called his brother-in-law, Sarge Shriver, you've all heard of him, and asked him to be the new first director. And Sarge reluctantly did that because he was thinking he was going to become the ambassador to France or a cabinet position. That's what he wanted. And his brother-in-law gave him this response. It couldn't have been a better decision for the Peace Corps, for America, and for the Kennedy administration as well. So that's a short version of the whole story.
Thanks. And Ron, even in the beginning, there are three goals.
Yeah.
And those three goals.
Okay. So that's what I was leading to. So Sarge started brainstorming and contacting the brilliant people to kind of figure this whole thing out, and they came up with three goals that the Peace Corps needs to have and be, and they haven't changed literally one word since then, 55 years earlier. We go to host countries, a country that says we'd like some teachers, we'd like some health workers, we'd like some agricultural expertise, whatever the need is in the country. And we think we'd like 50 to 100, a number. And so we go to countries that want to host us, the Peace Corps, and want to use a specific expertise. So we take a skill set abroad. Along with taking that abroad, of course, you're going to take the face of America. Because the Peace Corps volunteers live at the level of the people. I used to like to say we eat with them, we cry with them, we celebrate with them. And that is exactly what it is, because you're very much ingrained in the community you're serving in. So you're taking, and through that relationship building over a 2-year span of time, you're taking really what America is all about. So you're really bringing a genuine feeling and view of America. When the Peace Corps volunteer comes back, guess what? We bring some very deep understanding of the culture and all the innuendos of the people that we've served for 2 years. So you're bringing back to America a knowledge of the world that's pretty much irreplaceable in any way that I can think of, at least. So those are the three pillars. Skill set abroad by host country, the face of America abroad by living with the people and bringing back to America an understanding of a component of the world that probably could not be brought back any more clearly than that.
Thanks, Ron. The, if we jump around a little bit here, you mentioned a number of leaders, you're a leader, and you mentioned Kennedy, Shriver, and yourself, as we listen, recognize your leadership. Will you talk about what you think the most important characteristic of a leader is?
Well, I'm a firm believer in servant leadership, that you lead by example, by rolling up your sleeves and being with whatever you're trying to lead, and not just sitting in a king's chair somewhere. So work at the grassroots level with the people that are also trying to accomplish whatever the business is or the initiative. So servant leadership is my modus operandi. It has been all my business career, and certainly as when I was at the Peace Corps. And along with that, the other number one trait is directness and honesty. And I think I had that reputation. I know I had that reputation in the business world because I was always very direct, very clear with what the expectations are, but then your word is your bond. And clearly in the industry I was in, because all of the business in the brokerage industry is done by voice, by, you know, I'm going to buy you 10,000 shares of this or whatever it is, and it's all verbal, and millions of dollars change hands accordingly. And then the other component of my leadership is empowerment. I used to really work hard at hiring really competent, good people and giving them the full responsibility to perform their job. And one of the most satisfying parts of doing that is watching people grow and progress and become leaders themselves. And so that's kind of been my style of leadership. And
you mentioned Kennedy and how in his election and in that time period, you talked about this last night as well, and you just mentioned it changed the mindset of America, changed the mindset at least of generations. How important is that of national leaders?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but you know, I think what Peace Corps volunteers, there's now 225,000 Peace Corps volunteers that have returned from their service. There's probably another 25 to 50,000 staff people that have been abroad serving as country directors or various staff positions. And that's also a very unique experience, by the way. But let's say that's 300,000 people, I'm probably not too far off, have brought back to America over the last 55 years an understanding of 140 different countries. The Peace Corps has served in 140 different countries. Today, as we sit here, they're in 60 different countries. When I was director, we were in 74 different countries. So, I mean, that's a vast array of cultures and peoples, and now that expertise is here in America. Now, that's a small number when you look at 320 million people, but it's still an impactful number. And that's, you know, one of the beauties of what the Peace Corps has accomplished. It's never ending. And one of the most common comments that was made to me when the rumor got out that I was being considered to be director and I was going to be director and all of that is, do you mean the Peace Corps is still alive? I still get asked that question. Well, I want to tell you, it has never died. It's had its ups and downs over the years, but it's as vibrant today as ever. In 2008, that was my one of my years of directorship, we hit a 37-year high of number of volunteers in around the world. So it's a very vibrant initiative today. We've also made some changes. There was a thing called the Crisis Corps, which was when there was tsunami, remember the big tsunami in the Indian Ocean? And a lot of returned volunteers volunteered to go over there, knowing the languages, knowing the cultures, to help in a crisis situation like that. So we do that today. Today we call it Peace Corps Response. And right now what is happening, for example, they're putting, I think it's 25 doctors around in Africa to help with some very specialized needs on a short-term, six-month basis. And then at that point, they'll roll it again if need be and so on. So the Peace Corps is also changing with the times, with other ways to approach volunteerism and giving back.
And I was thinking, as you were just referencing Kennedy last night and then today, that time period, is there, for a president or for national leaders, was there something else? I mean, is that opportunity to create something positive and life-changing for so many people and impactful around the world possible for every president, I guess, or every
national leader? Well, sure, it is, but you do have to look at what's going on in the world as well. And for example, my biggest concern today as we sit here, we've never had a kidnapping in the Peace Corps of a volunteer. And you know, volunteers are in villages, they're vulnerable, there's no security corps around them or anything like that. So it's been a miracle almost. And so I fear, with all of the things that are happening around the world, that somewhere, somehow, someone is gonna get, just think about the impact this would have and pull something off like that. So the safety, my point of all this is, the safety and security of the volunteer is number one, two, and three on the agenda of what we do. When we were volunteers, we never even heard of that, okay? When I became director, I was introduced to, you know, the safety and security officer of the Peace Corps in the Peace Corps, Washington, D.C., and we have safety and security officers in every country that we're in. And it's a vast part of how the Peace Corps is functioning today. So my point of that is, it's a different world out mm-hmm. there. And so as the President of the United States and the delegation to the Director of the Peace Corps, you got, you know, the safety and security of those volunteers is of highest and utmost importance today.
One of the ways that the Peace Corps has changed over the years is something that you started to implement, your idea of recruiting folks mm-hmm. 50 years old and older. Will you share a little bit about that?
Well, I will. In the securities industry, the brokerage business, you pay attention to demographics real close. You like to know where the money is and where the money is coming from. And there is this phenomenon, and as I look around this room, there's several of us that may have been baby boomers, but the baby boomer generation is kind of an isolated group that we've watched for years as that has gone through education, the, you know, careers, and so on, and now into retirement. And I got to thinking about the baby boomers that were retiring at age 62 or 3 or 4 or 5, and the fact that they're still healthy, they have 30 years of experience, they have a reputation of being a giving generation, giving back, and you know, all the kinds of things we were talking about. Why not encourage them to join the Peace Corps? So we launched something called 50 Plus Initiative. Now, we've always accepted older volunteers. When we were volunteers as young, really young people, Lillian Carter, do you remember that name? She was in our group, as were two or three other older ladies who were nurses, and they were in India with us doing health work and so on. Anyhow, so we did all the homework to make sure we knew what we were doing when we say join the Peace Corps, because it's very different medically, it's very different from your personal finances. Think of all the differences that we have answers for. And actually I went and I shared this idea with Condoleezza Rice early on, and she was just all excited about it. She gave me great encouragement and support to do this. And so we said, well, it took us about 9 months to kind of put this whole initiative together. For some reason, we decided to launch it in Seattle, Washington. So we put a little blurb in the newspaper that the director of the Peace Corps was going to be at the University of Washington tonight. It's such and such an auditorium. And he's going to talk about his 50-plus initiative, da-da-da. We had no idea if one person would come or what the outcome was going to be. We got to the auditorium, which seated about 300 people, and it was packed. And people were standing in the aisles, standing in line to get in. I mean, we couldn't believe it. And so we did our thing and had a tremendous number of questions. I mean, the interest was very, very high. So we said, wow, we got something here. We went to Denver, Colorado, did the same thing, and the same outcome. We went to San Francisco, California, and did the same thing, and the same outcome. And so we knew that this is legit. And so we launched that. We doubled the number of 50-plus volunteers very quickly, and that number has continued to grow even over the last few years. So the point oftentimes was, I thought this was for kids right out of college. Well, it is. The average age is 27, so you know they've done a lot of them have done something already, like Nancy and I did when we worked for 2 years before we joined the Peace Corps. But it was really a successful initiative that we launched, and I think brought a whole new perspective to the Peace Corps in the field as well as back here at home.
And I would imagine the perspective, going back to the three goals, both what America is,
exactly,
in the countries, as well as when,
exactly,
when folks come back.
And in many of these countries, age is brings a tremendous amount of respect. So these older volunteers, you know, bring that to the table, the maturity and the respect for age. So I look at over this audience, the oldest volunteer right now is 81. The oldest that we know we've had is 86. So there's nobody in this room that could not be a volunteer yet. My recruiting pitch.
Can you volunteer twice?
Sure.
You go back?
Oh, yes. I've had a couple of gentlemen who are widowers. They would volunteer, they would extend, then they'd go back and start over again. And one guy did this for 12 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yes, there's all kinds of ways you can serve.
Would you and Nancy go back and volunteer?
If we didn't have grandkids, we probably would.
What country would you go to?
Oh my goodness, I'd pretty much go anywhere because we love the world. Having had the opportunity to visit 63 countries when I was director, so there'd be a lot of places that would be intriguing.
Would you share a highlight or two of those 63 countries?
Oh my goodness,
those 63 countries.
Yeah.
So for and a little background maybe,
yeah,
on that. So as director of the Peace Corps, how did you make that decision of where you wanted to go?
Well, you don't just decide. You don't just throw a dartboard. When I became director, the first thing I asked for is I want a list of all the countries that the director has never visited. And that there are many. Okay, so I had that list to work on.
Can I pause there?
Yeah.
Why was that important to you?
I think it's part of my leadership makeup, that I wanted to let those people know that you're as important as wherever the director was yesterday or whatever the case may be. So that's pretty much it. But then we actually talked about where we should start, what kind of message you want to deliver, because everybody's going to pay attention to the first country the director went to and so on. So we came up with Morocco and Jordan. Now they're interesting countries. They're Arab. And even, you know, 10 years ago, that was there were some issues around that. And so we wanted to send the message that you, an Arab country, to back to America, the Arab countries are very important to us. And so that was kind of the makeup of it. It was a great trip. Morocco is one of the most fascinating countries. I mean, you think of it being a vast desert, which it is, but it's got some history, thousands of years of history and culture that's unbelievable. And Jordan, of course, we know all about that. And had the honor and privilege to sit with the king and the queen there, and things like that you know, make it kind of meaningful to us as people as well. And then after that, we basically sat down with the staff. I have three regional directors at the Peace Corps, one for Africa, one for Asia and Eastern Europe, and the other for South America, the Caribbean and Pacific Ocean, basically, because we have a lot of volunteers down in the far islands of the Pacifics. And so we'd kind of put together four country trips. So my modus operandi was a day doing diplomatic things, visiting with the ambassador, usually the prime minister or the president or whoever the leader of the country is, and they welcome you. They can't, you know, say enough thanks and so on. Spend a day with the staff, Peace Corps staff office. A typical staffing in a country has 20 to 25 employees. There will be two or three Americans, the country director, usually the number two person, the deputy director, and the person that handles the purse strings are American, and then the rest are all local people. And so it's important to, you know, show the importance of the visit to them. And then 2 days in the field visiting volunteers, which is my favorite thing to do. And oftentimes they'd take us out to regional centers and have, you know, 10 or 15 volunteers come in from as many as a half a day away in some countries, and share experiences and listen to their frustrations, answer their questions, and that was a typical trip, pretty standardized after we got the rolling on it. And we did that any number of times. About 60% of my time was on the road traveling.
And another part of what you did during the, you spoke at commencements and you did a lot of speaking. Yeah. Was there a common theme in your messaging during that period of time?
There was.
To your audiences?
Yeah. I didn't know that came with the job, by the way, but I wasn't in the chair 1 week and I had a letter and they kept coming. And so what my chief of staff recommended is, well, let's just put these over here. Usually they come August, September for the next May, and then we'll pick from the list as we have time. So there were plenty of opportunities, but you could really only do three or four, because that's the key, you know, the peak graduation weekend. And the message I would try to get across is also service, the value of getting an international experience, and the impact it can have on your life, and what you can bring back to America with that expertise and experience and knowledge. And basically servant leadership is what I was indirectly talking about.
Can we run through some numbers?
Sure.
Number of countries that the Peace Corps is currently?
Currently it's 60.
60, mm-hmm. The highest that it's ever been?
100, no. We've served in 140 different countries. I think the height has been about 80.
At one point.
Yeah, at one point in time. Back, and that was in the late 1960s.
The number of volunteers today?
Today in the abroad is about 7,500.
The highest it's ever been?
15,000, 1967. And 15,000 volunteers around the world, and in 67 there were 1,500, 10% of those were in India, which is where we were.
The dream that Kennedy had, the number?
By now we'd have over 1 million return volunteers. Actually, I think he said within a decade, I can see having 1 million return volunteers.
And today we have?
225,000. So that goal was a little out of reach, but he sold it.
Mm-hmm. And the budget today?
The budget today is $410 million. And and that's a lot of money, but in the scheme of the United States government, what I used to tell congressmen and senators when I was pitching, this is not even a rounding error in the money you spend up here. And they would chuckle and, you know, yeah, you're right. But boy, it was hard to get more. And we had to work hard to get, you know, keep growing it. And this is the highest it's ever been. When I was director, it was $350 million. So.
And is one of the taglines or one of the ways that Peace Corps is sold is with the statement, hardest job you'll ever love?
The hardest job you'll ever love is one of the monikers that we
still
used to
today.
Use. Still today, right.
And
another one today is the world is calling. The world is calling, how far will you go? They're really catchy when you think about it.
when you and Nancy join, can I ask, with that tagline, what was the hardest part of being in India?
The lifestyle, the lack of conveniences. You know, we were in, I mean, our summers were 120 degree heat. There would never be electricity when you needed it, you know. And so it's just a harder lifestyle and less convenient. There was no telephone, no television, no radio even, unless you had shortwave. And so that's the hard part of it.
And the follow-up is, what did you love about it?
The people and the interaction, the ability to, you know, you were sitting at their level, you know, in a village in India, you never had a table. You'd sat on the floor when you ate. You never had utensils. You ate with your hands. And, you know, experiences that even now I kind of can't believe I did. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of that is the cultural interaction. You know, we were kind of a curiosity in this village in India. We're the first, not Caucasians, because they're basically Caucasians too, but we're the first people from America they ever saw or ever knew. And so they were curious, and it was a big deal for them for the village to see you walk into somebody's home, to be invited there. We got invited to so many weddings you couldn't believe it. And we had Hindus, of course, and there's various castes, and there's a whole variety of differences in those weddings. There were Muslims in our community, quite a few, as a matter of fact. They have a completely different structure and process in their marriage. And then there are Buddhists. And just think of all that interaction that we were able to participate in and observe. There's no cultural experience that can be richer than that.
Well, and that reminds me of another point that you made yesterday, bringing up this way. From here on South Dakota, I would suspect in the 60s it was predominantly 90%+ Caucasian.
Yeah.
And Minneapolis, still not anywhere near the diversity. And
right.
You go to another country, but you go and you're extraordinarily open and interested and curious and participating, living side by side with people. Where did that come from? What was the preparation to walk in the door, land in the country, and be that willing to learn about others?
Well, the Peace Corps did and does a very good job of preparing you for your experience. Our training back then was at the University of Chicago, and we were there for a reason. Number one, there were many Indians living in the greater Chicago area, and those wives, most of them were medical students or legal law students, things like that. The wives of these Indians were our language teachers, and they were well trained, so that helped us learn Marathi, which is the language of the state of Maharashtra in India. It's not Hindi, it's Marathi. And so the language training is a critical part of preparation. We certainly knew, we were community health workers, but our major job was family planning, education. And so we had all the family planning language down to a gnat's eye. I mean, we were really, could be clear and convincing in what we were trying to accomplish. So there's that. Then there's cultural experience, and how do you learn that? Well, at the University of Chicago, there was a world-renowned anthropologist and a world-renowned demographer. And so that's where we got all the foundation of understanding the cultures of India, the variety of cultures of India, and in preparation for that. And the demography part of it, of course, was the population growth, which we were trying to get under control. And we failed. But it was sure fun to try.
What do you hope that countries know about the Peace Corps? What do you hope countries around the world know about the Peace Corps?
Well, how much impact it's had in their country. And here's one example of that. Africa has 53 countries, mass of land, as you all know, and heavy population, and so on and so forth. 10 of the heads of these 53 countries, 10 of the heads of these countries, some of these countries, have had volunteers teach them in school. And so just think about the impact that has on these 10 who ultimately became presidents or prime ministers or, you know, whatever the top leadership role is in these countries. So you can't go around Africa very far or very long before you run into a Peace Corps interaction. We had a volunteer in our village, and he helped me this, and, you know, it goes on and on and on and on. So that's how most of Africa views the Peace Corps, is that they have really helped us get on our feet.
What's the biggest misunderstanding in your mind about the Peace Corps?
You don't stay long enough is one of them, because they really are sad when you leave and would like for you to stay longer. In some cases it happens, but not very often. I don't know of anything other than that.
When you think back to being director,
mm-hmm.
What do you know now that you wish you would have knew when you began that position?
Well, I guess I didn't know all the things that go with the job, like commencement addresses, like doing presidential delegations. You know, the president can't go to every funeral of the heads of state around the country, the world, or every inauguration. So I was on that list to do delegations. Normally it would be to a country where the Peace Corps had been and had influence. And I was representing the President of the United States at the inauguration mass. So I did that several times. I did it to Ghana, was one of them. Madagascar was another one. That's not a very commonly, I mean, it's a fabulous island and a fascinating culture, all kinds of good things about it. And I was the lead delegate to representing President Bush. I mean, it just kind of, I had to scratch my head a few times with some of those roles. But things like that, you know, come up. Or being invited to a state dinner. Ghana, for example, President Kofor was retiring from presidency of Ghana, one of the true, pure countries that have functioned properly in our view. And so when he came to visit President Bush, they had a state dinner, and we got invited to that. So all kinds of good things and challenging things become a part of the job.
You were the you were only the third returning volunteer to take this role. What advice would you give to the new director?
First of all, my first advice would be if you have the opportunity to take the job, because it's a fabulous job, that's usually not not the issue. Boy, I don't know, and that's one I haven't thought of. You've kind of thrown me a curve there. But I have talked to, like, the Carrie Hessler Radlett, who just served under Obama's administration. She's out now. The job has yet not been filled, by the way. And I did advise her when she called me in the early years. And more often, it would be after being in the chair for a while. And she said, I'm wondering if you could come to Washington and we could sit down and talk. And so I did that. So I'm available. We're all available as past directors. And then she would have, there's 10 living past directors. There were 17. I was the 17th. And she would invite all of us twice a year to come to D.C. And those are really fun experiences.
One of the things that you proposed while you were the director was a foundation.
Yep.
The creation of a foundation. Will you share a little bit about why that was important?
Well, I failed, first of all, but I had, as I looked at how the Peace Corps functioned, and as I talked to business executives around the country, I thought, you know, why wouldn't we have a foundation? So I started doing some legwork on it. We did it at the Peace Corps, and certainly we could do it. There are many governmental, like the Smithsonian Institute, for example, has a huge foundation, things like that. And the Peace Corps could do that. So we prepared the legislation, and then you've got to get sponsorship. So I did some work on the Hill, and I got bipartisan support, sponsorship of the bill. And we were going to drop it, introduce it in September of 08. And I got a call from, actually it was Pat Kennedy, Teddy Kennedy's son. He was then the congressman from Rhode Island. And he was very enthusiastic about this. And he helped me a lot in rounding up support in the House of Representatives. And he called me and said, Ron, we can drop the bill, but we have this thing going on right now called the economy, and it's taken all the attention of us here in the Hill, and it's going to die, or it's going to pass and die anyway. So we tabled it, and it's still on the table, and we're going to try to revive it now. I've had some conversations in the last couple of months about it, quite frankly. I don't know if it'll work as well today as it would have back then, but I don't know why it wouldn't, too. It's going to take a lot of work inside the Peace Corps, inside the government, as well as from the outside. So.
And the purpose of it is
the purpose of it is to support the function of the Peace Corps in the field. You know, you have a volunteer that's in a village and sees a great need. A school would be probably one of the most prevalent. And it doesn't cost a lot of money to build a school building in a lot of these third world countries. You don't have to have the fancy air conditioning and all of that. I mean, you can really, for a bang for the buck, it's huge. But this volunteer doesn't have, you know, it's huge, but it'll still call $50,000 or, you know, some number like that. That volunteer doesn't have resources. Now, they can go home and go to their local Rotary Club, and they can get a $10,000 block, but boy, above that, it's pretty hard. And so this foundation would have the ability to support those kind of larger functions in the field. And I think we could have had a $100 million, and by today, a $200 million foundation already. Had we been able to launch it like I wanted to. There was a, be careful, a lot of that, I heard some of it from the Hill and some of it from the street, which is if when Congress finds out you've got that pool of money, they're gonna cut your budget over here. Well, maybe I'm too naive, but I said, I can figure that out, you know, how we can keep our budget rolling through the government, but also use the foundation money for projects and so on. So it's still a dream I have.
You talked about the intense process to become director.
Yeah.
What was the highlight of that process?
Getting finished.
Yes.
Or getting cleared.
Will
getting
you tell
cleared.
That story? That.
Well.
The end of that story.
Yeah. When I said yes to the question back then, I had no idea. First step was a telephone interview with White House personnel. And then at the end of that, they said, can you be here tomorrow? I said, no. I'm on the board of directors, and I've got a board meeting, and you know whatever was going on. But so I took about 10 days before I found time to go in. And the process is, once you get to that point, you're not the only candidate, first of all. There's usually three or four that are being considered, and that was the case here. And they never tell you anything. And as we're going along, of course, my wife knew it from day one, right? Except in the middle of July, this all started in April, okay? In the middle of July, I got a call from White House personnel, and he said, you know, you are one of the finalists. I'm not gonna tell you if you're the finalist, but you're one of the finalists. And he said, you can tell your wife now. And so I did, but she knew it already anyway. But that, but that whole process, you know, it goes on and on. It just so happened August is recess month on the Hill, and I was living in Minnesota. I knew a guy by the name of Norm Coleman, who was one of our senators, so I made an appointment to see him, and he didn't even know that I was on the list where I was, and he was very pleased with all that. And he said, and I said, you know, time is running out here, and I'd really appreciate expediting this. He said, Ron, I really can't do anything, but I'll see what I can do. And the whole deal was to go. By that time, I was the person chosen, okay. But now you got to go through the Senate hearing, you know, all that process, and then you got to go through the has to go to the floor and so on. And he said, Ron, this usually takes 3 months. And I said, well, anyway, what he did is he arranged for the day they come back from recess, which is the day after Labor Day, to have my hearing. He had it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, so there was only about three of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee was who I had to go before, and I think there were three present. Well, that made that process really easy, okay, and Dodd was one of them. He was a returned Peace Corps volunteer, Senator Dodd, and so it was a love-in. It wasn't I didn't get grilled at all, and so that process, and then he arranged Norm. Arranged for the vote to go to the floor the next week, which is unprecedented. And the Peace Corps couldn't understand how this was happening. But, you know, it was just lucky that Norm was so supportive and so on and so forth. And so I got through that whole process in 3 months rather than 6 to 12 is what it amounted to. And gave me that much more time to serve in a unique way. So it is a process, and you just have to do it. And it's no different today, by the way, I'm told.
And actually you were in the Oval Office is where.
Oh yeah, the swearing in was in the Oval Office. They basically said, you know, we can swear you in any way you want. So I was sworn in my office at the Peace Corps to make me legal so I could sit in the chair. But then they have the ceremonial swearing in a little later, and that was at the, and they said, we got an auditorium over there. You can bring up to 200 people if you want. You do it anyway. I said, I'd just like to have my immediate family there. And so that's who was in the Oval Office with me when we were sworn in, and it was a tremendous experience.
You could live anywhere, and you've traveled all over the world, but you choose to live here in South Dakota, in the Black Hills.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I was born, I'm a South Dakotan, and I didn't know that I was ever come back to even after retirement, but my son and daughter-in-law helped on that because they were living in Florida and decided they didn't want to raise a family in Florida, so they moved to Rapid City. That's thanks to the fact that we brought our kids out here a lot of times over the years, and it's a wonderful place. I mean, the people, you are, you know, I walk down the sidewalk of Rapid City, people smile and say, yeah, hi, and you know, it's just a very different environment from Minneapolis or New York City or wherever else it might be. So it's the people and the environment that's important to us, and we love it out here. Dearly love it.
Ron, I really appreciate your time this morning, last night. We've got some more meetings. You'll be on South Dakota Public Broadcasting later today. And one of the things that I thought of, I was thinking about last night after dinner, was a phrase that you used and actually came up already this morning, the introduction of people living in a different way. And you used that to describe a bit about your experience last night in India, and talking more broadly that the Peace Corps allows volunteers to see around the world how people just live differently. And I think that idea, that simplicity, that statement is so beautiful in so many ways, that there are different ways of living. And I really appreciate you sharing last night, today.